all, and I hope to see you next time.
Peace.
WSLR LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPV LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Lou Larini with your WSLR news headlines for May 28th, 2025. USF secretly planned transfer of campus to new college. While it didn't make it as a bill, this legislative session recently uncovered emails by public records request revealed that USF leadership had quietly drafted a plan to hand over their Sarasota Manatee campus to neighboring New College, even as they worked to keep the public in the dark about such a move. The records obtained last week by WUSF uncovered a level of involvement far deeper than previously acknowledged and a coordinated effort to keep it under wraps as takeover rumors began to spread. Among the emails is an exchange from February about a draft bill USF officials prepared detailing the transfer of the 32-acre Sarasota Manatee campus and its facilities, including newly built dormitory buildings that opened to students last year, to New College. More affordable housing is opening in Bradenton. Bradenton's affordable housing market is getting a boost this month with the opening of Astoria on 9th, a new $37.4 million apartment complex for seniors. Developed by Housing Trust Group in partnership with AM Affordable Housing, a nonprofit founded by NBA Hall of Famer Alonzo Mourning, the project will bring 120 affordable one- and two-bedroom apartments meant to cater to older residents upon opening yesterday. Astoria, located at 2244 9th Street West, just a few blocks south of Lecom Park, caters specifically to elderly residents. The apartments are reserved for seniors earning at or below 22%, 30%, and 60% of the area median income, with rents starting as low as $322 per month. Canada's snowbirds are selling homes and canceling trips as trade war heats up. Gulf Coast News recently reported on a mass exodus of Canadians from Southwest Florida as new travel regulations are imposed and the trade war escalates. More home purchases in the U.S. are done by Canadians than any other country, 13% from April 2023 to March 2024, the National Association of Realtors says, as reported by CBC News. Half of all Canadian purchases were vacation homes, and roughly 41% of sales were in Florida. This will likely have a ripple effect on the tourism industry and local businesses. This has been Lou Larini with your WSLR news headlines for May 28th, 2025.
Okay, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. I'm Tom Walker. This is WSLR, your local news and radio station. The views and opinions, by the way, are expressed by myself, our guests, and callers are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or its employees and volunteers. John Dickman's on the board. Thank you, John, for helping out. And we'll see now our guest today. Say hello, Elizabeth.
Hello.
Okay, he heard you. He heard you, and I think he went out over the air. Our guest today is Elizabeth Minnick. Dr. Minnick earned her MA and PhD in philosophy from the Graduate Facility for Political and Social Science of the New School of University in New York, where she was a teaching assistant for Hannah Arendt. And we'll talk about her in a minute. She wrote her dissertation on John Dewey and has continued to work on issues of democracy and education with particular focus on inclusive scholarship, curricula, teaching, and institutional practices. As an academic administrator, she has been a dean and or director at the New School, now called Lang College, within Sarah Lawrence College, Hollins College, and Barnard College on the undergraduate level. She has also been a dean of the Union Institute and University's Graduate College for Interdisciplinary Arts and Sciences. Wow. She has taught at all these institutions. Special appointments have included professor of philosophy and the humanities at the Hartley Burr Alexander Chair at Scripps College, a visiting scholar and scholars and seminars program, the Getty Institute, Thomas B. Johnson, distinguished writing professor, Rollins College, on and on, and too many to mention here. What a credentialed young lady. She now divides her time between Charlotte, North Carolina, where she's a professor of moral philosophy, which we're going to talk about, at Queens College, and Washington, D.C., where she's a senior scholar at the Association of American Colleges and Universities. How about that for a resume? Congratulations, Elizabeth. And you found time to write a book. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much. Enough to make you tired, isn't it?
Well, your new book, well, it's not a new book. It's your 2016 book, which you've issued a new release of with new forward, new afterward, new thoughts. It's called The Evil of Banality, on the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. And we're going to be talking a lot about thinking. But that title is similar to one by Heron Arendt, a book about Adolf Eichmann, and called Eichmann in Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil. And yours is The Evil of Banality. Talk about that book and then your book and how they relate and how you came about all of this. Just go ahead and give us a broad introduction to your work.
Well, that's a good place to start, of course. Thank you, Tom. And it's always, a challenge and a pleasure to talk about my teacher. Such an extraordinary thinker and turned out philosopher, turned out to be astoundingly astute politically. It's a nice combination and relatively rare.
Yes.
Hannah Arendt was a refugee from Germany. She was Jewish, and she fled in time. She had good judgment about that. She had been arrested already. She knew it was time to leave Germany. And she went to Europe, where she was again put in a camp by the French.
Wow.
And when the Allies liberated the camp, no, I said before that they challenged it. In any case, there was a moment in which there was confusion. The camp then shut back down, but there was a moment in which there was confusion, and she and a few of the women who were held in this camp walked out. Most of them by then had been broken enough, were scared enough, didn't know where they were in France and so forth, and they stayed. That stuck with me because it's just typical of Hannah.
She just walked out.
She just walked out. She was so in touch with reality. She had a phrase, amor mundi, for love of the world. And for all that she had seen, she really meant that. But she meant the world as it is. As it is. No lying about it. No retreat. No covering it up with ideology or cliches. In any case, she persuaded Mr. Sean of the New Yorker, when she had made it to this country later, to send her to Jerusalem to cover the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who is known as the engineer of the final solution of the Nazi genocide, effort at genocide of the Jews. He had been captured and he was taken to Jerusalem to stand trial for crimes against humanity. She wanted to cover the trial. So she went. I have to say, Mr. Sean really impressed her. She said to me at one point that he was the most intelligent man she'd ever met. This is a woman who studied with the great philosophers of Germany. I thought that was interesting. And it would be somebody involved in journalism, in speaking with public and caring about that, that she would admire so much. She sat in the trial. She read transcripts. She studied, of course. She learned a great deal. And then, as she put it, she found herself with a concept, which was banality of evil, which was a great shock because she had arrived pretty much thinking about the radical evil. What else would you call genocide? And of course it's radical, monstrous, horrific, mind-stopping, unthinkable, all of those things. And before her, as she watched and as she read transcripts of interviews with him and so forth, was this pale, twitchy, balding guy in a suit who was trying as hard as he could to be a good witness, just as he had tried a witness against himself. Excuse me, that's a crucial point. He wanted to behave well, to show that he understood the charges against him, that he too was horrified at the deed that this person himself. I mean, it's curious. It's curious. And it's eloquent because, of course, he was the engineer of the final solution. He arranged it such that people could be taken to the camps to be murdered.
Right.
And he knew that. And what he did was his job. People are still arguing about whether he was a virulent anti-Semite or not. What I would want to say about that is it doesn't matter. If he was, he still had to do his job every day, effectively, efficiently. It wasn't about a burst of passion. It wasn't about, losing it and going out to wipe out these people. To commit genocide, things have to run effectively. That's a hard job.
Mm-hmm.
He had to do a good job, which he did. One of the things that Hannah Arendt said about him was that his only outstanding characteristic, this ordinary little man who was trying to do whatever job he was given as well as he could, his one outstanding characteristic was a radical thoughtlessness.
And you're right, and banality, lacking in originality, boring, right?
Yes, thank you. We do need to define it. That's important. I would think of banality as the ordinary, which can be vibrant and wondrous, but with the life sucked out of it.
Okay, all right.
Right, reduced to cliche, convention, habits, normalized in ways that make us turn off our attention.
Mm.
It's a kind of autopilot.
Right.
And that's what she saw in him. That he simply never stopped to think. No dark nights of the conscience. He was doing his job. His other striking characteristic, she said, was a perhaps, she had ironic tone quite often, which infuriated people. In the presence of such serious subjects, she would say his other striking characteristic was a perhaps undue interest in his own advancement.
Mm.
So what we had was this guy was doing his job, deeply touched when his superiors, as he said, condescended to him, took him out for a beer with them. Very interested in his job. He was still complaining about not having been promoted after he was in Jerusalem on trial, which everybody knew the result of, for his life. And he's still complaining to the psychiatrist who's interviewing him, that he was not properly promoted. That's a banality on a profound level, to speak that language. So that's what she did, and she shocked a lot of people because you don't equate banality and evil. They're not equivalent, right?
Yeah, right. But in fact, that's the way it occurred. It occurred, yeah.
Yeah. Well, and we deeply want, we have a great stake in, I've encountered this a lot, listening to her, listening to the way people responded to her, which was a lot of people with highly personalized fury. She was very controversial, still is to some extent. She took me along to some of the places where she spoke, because I was her teaching assistant, and she was like that. And I heard the things that people said. She went right on standing up in front of people and talking about what she had meant and what she had said until, as she said, it became clear that people were attacking her for a book they hadn't read.
Wow.
It was that phrase and a couple of things in the book, none of which are in question anymore. But this is fairly soon after the horrors had been so devastatingly halted, ever more death to do that. And the idea that an ordinary but reduced to banalities and convention cliches, careerism, man, could be, have done such horrific things. Horrific. You made it possible. Two people can't commit genocide. You have to have
hundreds,
all
thousands.
Kinds of people.
Yeah.
Over time, working, doing their jobs. So, I mean, he's responsible. And certainly she never denied that, and she never denied the horror of what he did. And there she was with this person who was basically, you know, a banal careerist who liked cliches, lovely moral phrases. He loved to speak moral talk. There's a banality of good, too.
And you turned the phrase around in your book to the evil of banality. So explain that thinking and what your book is about.
Yes, I sat there in the back of those rooms way back when she was being variously attacked and so forth. And at one point it occurred to me to wonder if she had spoken about the evil of banality, if she might have had a chance to say what it was she was trying to say.
Got it.
Yeah. And that just stayed in my mind and became... Okay, here's what I wanted. To go from radical evil, which we explain by moral monstrosity, so that the character, the moral standing, is equivalent to the act. Both are monstrous. She went from that to a lack of equivalence. A trivial, foolish, overly obedient, etc. person who was actively involved in horrific harm. That lack of equivalency is still hard for people, very hard. So I basically set out, I didn't know I was doing it for some years, but I was. I read all kinds of things and I talked with people and so forth. I needed to understand what it was about banality, if it turned out to be the case, that enabled such horrific harm doing. Mm-hmm. That seemed to me to be one of the pressing moral political concerns I could possibly try and think through.
Right. And so it turns out that maybe it was what you call unthinking. And a lot of your book is about thinking. So he wasn't thinking. Well, he knew what he's doing, but all of the people who went along with what he did were unthinking in a sense. And I think that's one of the points in your book, right? That we must become more thoughtful and aware in our daily lives. Talk about thinking, and that's a part of the title of your book. Importance of thinking. What do you mean by thinking? And of course, everybody thinks as they go about their daily life, but you mean something special by thinking, I think.
I do. And it's tricky, of course, because thinking is, in a sense, a very common term.
Right.
For the activities of our brains that we experience in our minds. What I had in mind and have tried to work through on multiple levels is what it is about the activity of our minds that allows us, that enables conscience, an awareness of what we're doing and the potential to judge it. Doesn't mean we will do that. We cannot do it. We can turn off our consciences and we can turn off our minds. We do it all the time. I mean, this is nothing. It's common. We couldn't get through the day if we were thinking, you know, full on aware of everything
right.
all day.
Right.
Conventions are useful. Clichés are useful. I'm not condemning these things per se. I'm saying they can be deadly, dangerous when we're within, when a system is moving into, particularly when it's moving into and can be stopped. What I've come to call it, this is in my book I've been working on recently, so totalizing power, totalizing dominance.
Yeah.
When there's a shift from a more complex, balanced, maybe messy, could even have been something like a dictatorship, not necessarily a struggling would-be democracy, can be all kinds of forms, but it's not totalized. You know, into every corner of people's lives, as terror does when people are afraid to speak and afraid to act. Then you don't have to point guns at us. We'll behave.
Yeah.
I think a key point is that we need to be able to be startled back into thought. We go through our lives as we do. But we have to have enough attentiveness that we can say, no, this is different. Or I've done these things that I really don't want to admit. Yes, I have. But you know, this I will not do. If I do this, I'm not who or what I thought anymore. And sometimes those lines, we cross them and don't realize it. Sometimes we realize it a little later. You know, again, very few people have the kind of astuteness that somebody like Hannah Arendt actually did time and time again. We get habituated. Things are normal. We're busy. We don't think of ourselves as saints anyhow. But if we're not able to be startled back into thinking, one of the things that awareness, not just awake, but aware, that doubled consciousness, mm-hmm. in which I can say to myself, you just mucked up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right? Conscience means there are two of me.
Right.
I can think about my thinking.
Right.
I can watch myself. I can also lie to myself,
right.
which I find fascinating. So there's this gap in our consciousness. That's what it means, consciousness. Conscientia means thinking with, knowing with. This has been known for a very long time about humans and maybe other creatures that we know it about humans. We have this gap. It's the gap of human freedom. It's what allows us choice, and it also makes us responsible. So that's where, because we have choice, that's where morality becomes possible. So a baseline importance of thinking is to activate and practice, come to feel the intense aliveness of being aware, being open to being aware, not every minute of every day. Because without that, I arrived at one of the lines in my book that was difficult for me to come to, was that people who are not thinking are capable of anything.
Right. That not only Germany, but Rwanda and Gaza and child trafficking, as you point out, slavery for many hundreds of years. And they were all going along and not thinking about it very much. So these, would you call these people thoughtless? Or were they just, again, bureaucrats or functionaries? And would you call all those people evil? I'm not sure if evil is a good, were each one of them evil? Or is evil a good word? It seems like it sets somebody apart. He's a special case. We forget about him. Too bad he was evil. But I'm not sure it's a good term. And we think, oh, that won't happen again. He was evil. It's like it's almost a religious term. So you like the term evil? Is that what we might apply to all of the people in Rwanda? Or what were they?
That's very helpful, Tom. Thank you. I don't mean it in a theological sense. By evil, I mean something that's so bad we can't just say it was bad.
It's worse
it's
than
our
bad,
term.
So to speak.
What?
Yeah.
It's worse than bad. Uh-huh. Yeah. It breaks our categories. That's where you get the unthinkable, unspeakable.
Okay.
Right. We don't know how to think about it. We're knocked over. So that's what I mean by evil. And the conjunction, with banality, the key point in, I'm going to say finding that conjunction, it became illuminated for me. And I hope also for others, through this book, those people who are kind enough to think with me through it. When it struck me, as I was studying all these instances of monstrous harm, cross history, cross cultures, that there were, it's always silly to divide things in two because everything is much more complicated than that. But I'm about to divide this in two.
Okay.
Sometimes it's useful, as long as one doesn't get rigid about it. I wanted to say there really are two kinds of that sort of evil. One of them is what we were talking about before, the monstrous, and you just brought it up again very helpfully, Tom, where we have the moral equivalency, the deed, the actor. Those are typically brief, one or a few people, serial killers, shooters who then die, somebody who kidnaps and tortures and eats their victims, some kind of a small sect that does bad things to people. And when people around, when they find out, are shocked, horrified, they say that's extraordinary. This is not us. That doesn't happen here.
Okay.
Right? Got it? Okay. I call that intensive evil.
Yeah.
Short term, few people, extraordinary, monstrous. Equivalent. Deed and doer. Broadly speaking. However, that does not get anywhere near what I was trying to understand, which were these evils, these great harm doing. You listed some of them. Enslavement of other human beings, building whole economic systems on the basis of that enslavement, in which shipbuilders and suppliers and chain makers and, guides and bakers that brought bread that was parceled out very meagerly, but it was made by somebody and brought. So it takes all kinds of people working over time to do what I now call extensive evils. Sexual abuse, violation of the vulnerable that's gone on for millennia, child labor, often unto death, and stunting in all kinds of ways, can be found all kinds of places. These systems that do enormous harm, and when we're outside of them, we look at them and we say,
right.
Horrifying. They last. And they are normalized. The authorities go along with it. You can find science lining up, if you're in various kinds of science, lining up to say this is based on truth. They are inferior. They don't feel pain like we do. They,
Right.
You find science, you find religion reaching it. You find workers doing their jobs. You find people, reliable workers, not just functionaries, not just bureaucrats. Everybody. Everybody. I also say throughout the book, in parentheses, because it matters so much, and there's a section on extensive and intensive good in the book, too.
Well, let's talk about that, too.
I have to keep putting things in parentheses saying, but not all, not everybody, never everybody. There are always those who don't. Always. And that's very important. So I did a lot of reading about those, too, across cultures and history to try and understand how that possible, just to sort of, if insofar as it wraps that up, which of course it doesn't adequately, for extensive evils to set in, things that were shocking last week have to be less so or blocked out of mind by a remarkable number of people this week.
I worry about that even today.
Precisely.
With Trump. We could talk about him later, but yeah, it's gradually either being ignored or overlooked, or it's a slow slide. Keep going.
Yeah.
That's how it happens.
That is how it happens. That is how it happens. Extensive evils cannot happen without us.
Got it.
All of us. They're not the intensive ones. They make use of intensive to frighten us.
Right.
The intensive will happen, and it can have extraordinary effects because it scares. You see it scares you, and then you become, you start being thoughtless about what's happening. One starts being thoughtless about what's happening, shut our minds off prematurely. It hasn't totalized before actual threat, likely threat even. We will start behaving.
We look away.
And we will start behaving. Some of us will do it. Look at the law firms. Excuse me, that's jumping ahead.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I remember,
that's careerism.
Yeah, yeah. Careerism, profit, personal advantage, status, things you might lose, might not get ahead as quickly. Going along, I remember I was in Germany in 65, and I knew some parents of friends who had been in the Wehrmacht, in the army, and I was talking to some of the people who lived nearby the concentration camps, and they said, and this is a quote I remember, they said, "We didn't want to know." Isn't that a sort of conscious, unconscious, letting themselves off the hook? "We did not want to know." That's a very scary phrase. But now you can't say that Americans don't know what's happening, but somehow we're letting it slide again into what I would call some sort of evil. And well, go ahead, you know.
Well, the life and death importance of thinking is right there, because there are times when we really must pay attention and make choices, act, or in some cases not support other people in acting. What's crucial, I'm sorry, I paused there because I was thinking there will be moments for every one of us where we have to make choices.
Right.
We may be able to defer them, but that, in a sense, is already something of a choice. And the further the concentric circles of obedience without even direct threat go, the quicker it happens, the broader it spreads, the more frightening it is, it compounds. And who's doing that? We're doing that.
Yes.
That's extensive evil. Those people sitting there in their conference rooms with their phones and they couldn't do any of this.
Gotcha.
They're not capable of it on so many levels. They may want it badly and so forth, but not all by themselves, and maybe not at all. You know, Eichmann threw up the one time he actually saw what his work led to, apparently.
Jeez.
And then he went back and, you know, went back to work, shut it off. We can do that, and we will do it. I think I want to say that we will do that, since it takes all of us, and we are not such wonderful creatures all the time, every day. And, you know, I don't want to be, we're not saints. We're not intensive good either. Most of us, some are, thank goodness. But we will have many chances to make choices and to do or not do certain things. If I mess up today, I don't have to flagellate myself and say, "That's it, I'm done, I'm a terrible person." I'll have another chance. It's guaranteed I'll have another chance. And it's pretty fine-grained, the normalizing into a whole system of a plan, a project of doing great harm. So that's extensive evil, and that's where we get to the banality.
Well, let's talk also about good, intensive and extensive good. You talk about in your book, For instance, there was a village in called Le Chambon in World War II, where they did an amazing thing. They were French Protestants. Tell us that story. It's very uplifting.
It is indeed, and there are by now several books about Le Chambon and a couple of other of the Protestant villages in the mountains in southern France that resisted the Nazis. It's fascinating. They were, for one thing, they were Protestants in Catholic France. They had had experience of oppression and of being outsiders from what we now call marginalization to active. So they had a kind of outsider stance, but that wasn't the core of their being. They were a religious community, and they were, they had a pastor, an assistant pastor, and the pastor's family who, were pacifists and went to Le Chambon, had gone to Le Chambon to be the pastor and serve it. And they started a school that they thought would be good for Le Chambon to have another, in effect, business employer, because it was a poor village, isolated up in the mountains in many ways. They started a school that taught many things, but basically what it was doing was teaching pacifism.
Okay.
And when the Nazis began to spread down from occupied Paris, they weren't in Paris, so it's a different situation, but they were there. As they started to do that, this small group of people at the center of a also small village prepared. One of the key lines throughout, I keep saying we have to be attentive, key lines that I took from that book about this, about goodness, is we have to be prepared for goodness too. They prepared. The pastor gave sermons in which he talked about what was happening factually in the world. So people were informed. He formed study groups. First he had one with six people, and then each one of those six people went out and had a group of six people. So just about everybody was in a small group talking about what was happening in the world and what it meant to them. And they did it largely in the context of biblical study, more and less directly. This was because the biblical study was for them how to live.
Mm-hmm.
That was core to them. I mean, the pastor was known to say, a doctrine, yeah, no, I want to know how you live. So that was the focus. So they had study groups. They knew each other. They trusted each other. They already had communication links. They met regularly in kitchens and living rooms and so forth. And at one point, an order came that they should take down the French flag and put up the swastika flag. We'll just call it the Nazi flag. And the pastor called a meeting, and everybody gathered, and they disagreed about whether they should do it or not. And finally, they decided that they wouldn't do it. Without anybody, they were careful not to try to silence the people who thought they should. Mm-hmm. They went on talking about it, but they made a decision as a group, and they did not change the flags. Well, this is a pretty good choice. They got lucky in some ways that was the first direct order, because nobody knew. You know, the Nazis were not walking around the town square every day. They showed up every now and again. So they disobeyed and they succeeded. That's very good. They were practiced. They got confidence. They further trusted each other. They went on trusting each other, although they had disagreed. So all of this, I mean, I keep pulling things out from that throughout the book about, it's Philip Halley's phrase, the author of this book, Lest Innocent Blood Be Shed, it's called. That was the one. There's another one that talks about all three that's very good. Very good. Actually, it has more history in it. In any case, what he's concerned about is, I said, be able to be on time.
Got it.
That hadn't been in my mind. I now think that's why I took a step back even and joined with, attentiveness, and communication with many people in groups, small groups, but attentiveness, practicing attentiveness. One of the things that the, pacifists knew and talked about is you can't lay down your arms as a pacifist in the middle of a war. You just get people killed and it will do no good. That was searing experience for some of these people, and they shared those experiences. You can be kind, be part of something because you're already in it. It's a very different situation. Doesn't mean sometimes you can act in the middle of things. There's stories about people doing that. Like the wives, I don't like saying German versus Jewish because the Jewish citizens were also German. But anyhow, let's say Christian German wives of Jewish German husbands. The husband, fairly early on in the Nazis, they weren't fully consolidated yet. They arrested the husbands. Mm. And the wives, one by one, it wasn't coordinated, went to one of the major squares in the center of their town, to get information, to say, what can I do? I need information. Where is he? And so forth. And it turned out there were a fair number of them there, and the wives, and they talked to each other, and they stayed, and more came. Same thing happened with the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo in Argentina.
Yes.
Right. When their pregnant daughters had been disappeared by the junta, and the grandmothers, very, very conventional, traditional women who didn't do politics, they went out to ask, what happened to the child. They knew what had happened to their daughter, but they didn't know what had happened. If there had been a child born, and what had happened. Same thing. Turned out there were a lot of them. And they stayed. And they ended up winning. I think they got a Nobel at one point, actually. They established the right to identity.
Right.
Incredible. They didn't mean to. They were going about their business, but they were trying. They needed something. They needed help. There was trouble. And then they looked around and they saw each other. And in these cases, it turned out they were in time. As we know, the British mowed people down, when they were, when India was still in the empire.
Right. Right.
So it's not, who you're against. It is a lot about it. People like to say, Gandhi's techniques, Gandhi and millions of other people, would never have worked against the Germans. Well, actually, the British did not have a happy legacy either. So there's a lot about timing, preparation, trust, practice.
And that's what you would call extensive goodness then, what the villagers did, what the mothers in Argentina did, right?
Yes.
Practicing goodness in an everyday, ongoing way and being aware.
And they all said, every one of them, and you find this where it's extensive goodness, what I found over and over again, and this will be entirely familiar to you, is when asked later, the typical response is, no, I'm not a hero. I mean, what was I to do? I was just doing this.
Well, that's it. That's the trait we need. I wasn't a hero. I was just doing what I had to do.
Yeah. Does it? What? It's sort of like, almost a kind of outrage in the villages at Le Chambon. We said, no. Don't, no.
Interesting.
What was I going to do? Slam the door in the face of Jews who came for help? No.
And they saved 2,000 Jews, I think, or more.
Yeah. Got them over the border into Switzerland. I have other stories about a Swiss border guard. Also, this one stayed intensive. Good, quietly, but it was intensive. When Switzerland decided to, it become too Jewified.
Uh-huh.
After being so good, for so long and the place that people fled to.
Uh-huh.
And they tightened the border. this very conservative border guard, very conservative, patriot, good border guard, started bit by bit by bit bending the rules, getting people in anyhow. He just couldn't do it when people stood in front of him. Thinking doesn't have to be extraordinary empathy or analysis or wide-ranging awareness. It's, there's this person in front of me. Look at this person. This, too, is a person. And that's what he did. He couldn't do it. Whereas part of what struck me was a crusading, I think it was a journalist, activist, just across the hall from this office, who was always fighting for justice and so forth. He caved immediately.
Huh.
The quiet, conservative person who believed he was serving his country and that Switzerland was a good country because it was welcoming, he didn't.
So,
unfortunately, he had a difficult life. He lost his job. People turned on him. He's a hero now. He's dead now. It took a long time. He didn't have other people. He didn't, there was no organizing. There were, no communities that he turned to that worked with him where it spread. He did it. It was intensive.
Right.
He saved lives. No question about it.
His character, his inner character helped mm-hmm. there.
Mm-hmm.
So we have examples then of intensive and extensive goodness. And so let's go on about thinking. You talk about thinking a lot in your book. I was interested in one paragraph. By the way, we're talking to Elizabeth Minnick, author of The Evil of Banality, on the life and death importance of thinking. Let's talk about thinking. You said in one of your paragraphs, you said in another book, the one that kept trying to write itself as I worked on this one, I will try to think through an education that can free us not only from the weight of ignorance, but also from the deadly hole of banality. What are you thinking? Is that a new book? Or is that a new course? What do you want people to practice or to do or discover?
The simplest response is to practice regularly. I don't mean like grinding away practice. I mean like an action, mm-hmm. something that one does.
Mm-hmm.
Watching our own thinking, watching our own language,
mm-hmm.
and similarly for other people, but we can just do this, first off with ourselves. So that, for example, one of the phrases that is common in education, which is where I spent most of my life, is the distinction between education and training.
Mm.
For education, everybody, it's a cliche in this way. He says, educare means to lead out, to open, to expand, to open your mind. Mm-hmm. I always think of one of the important things of a good education is one that gives us a whole lot of thinking friends. So we're not alone and we're not without community and we're not without those voices. One of the things I discovered, incidentally, just to throw this in oddly, people who were in camps, people who were under detention, people who were in solitary, one of the ways some actually managed to survive, and I mean sane, and also they survived physically. Interesting connections. I don't even want to explore it because I couldn't possibly do that. But anyhow, people who recited poetry to themselves.
Huh.
They had things in their mind to turn to, but not necessarily poetry, And people mention, well, I had memorized this, I had this, and I recited, or I wrote
nice.
Poems.
Yeah.
So you keep the mind active, you tend to keep the body active too. We are embodied minds after all. What I'm talking about with this kind of thinking is enlivening. It's not just good for us morally. It's enlivening. It makes the ordinary richer, as attentiveness does. So what I'm after is that kind of self-awareness, which can also trip us up where we sort of say something and then think, oh goodness, did I say it that way? No, that was so stale. Or I didn't really mean that, which is also, you know, an outgrowth of caring about other people. One model for the kind of thinking, for this sort of reflexive thinking, which we think about our own thinking, hear ourselves talking, are aware of language and what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It is, of course, the our care for other people that then extends into being able to think in their place, not feel, think, see how things look for them, or how it would look if we were in their shoes, as we like to say.
Wow.
Switch over and look afresh. You were in that position. What would you? You don't have to think in their place either. What would you think? So that we practice our ability to go traveling, whether we're traveling or not, as I know you care about.
Yeah.
And traveling will do the same for, can do the same for. So we want flexible minds that refuse to remain on any one track. I talk about one track minds. The phrase we use, and if you're around somebody or you yourself, as we've all done it, you just, you know, oh my God, I really just have a one track mind about this. I cannot stop thinking about it and it keeps going the same place. You know, I'm just on here. We have to practice the pleasure. We have to free ourselves getting off that train, walking around it, looking at it. So, and looking at where it's going and where else it might possibly go, where it came from. I talk a lot about enclosures of thought in the book and explore a number of them. That's one of the reasons that it's not terribly long, but it got longer than it was because I explored a variety, in part, because I explored a variety of enclosures of thought where, as in, I'm thinking about my career, and my career is in this law firm, and my whole meaning system, as we were saying earlier, sort of, I get my meanings there and I know who I am there. I plan my future that way. I have my friends that way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm a law firm.
Right.
And it turns out that we become capable of violating the law and damaging it badly to preserve a law firm. That's an enclosure of thought.
Mm-hmm.
Toni Morrison, the wonderful Toni Morrison, calls these our fish bowls that we swim around that invisibly contain us. We all have them. And not necessarily, again, not necessarily a bad thing. It depends on the context and the setting and, you know, what's going on around us. So, I mean, people are talking a lot about that now. You get in this group and, you know, you don't get out. You get in your bubble and you don't get out.
They call them silos or, right.
Yeah. Yeah, we know the danger, and we're getting glimpses again now, in particular, of the fact that it can be deadly danger. So, I want an education that is, I would say, never primarily training. Although certainly there can be training, as long as we also then reflect on it and have to think about it. What's it for? Where did it come from? We did a major at one of the colleges I worked with. We did a major, a liberal arts major in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
Not a professional major, although a fair number went on to architecture graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
But that's really very interesting. If you follow what is now a profession and an art, through its history, how its meanings developed, who it served, who it didn't serve, its whole long history, you have a whole different relation to that profession. Instead of just entering into it, being socialized into it, learning everything you know about how to do your work in it within the terms that have developed for so long, as if they had no history and context. They do. We all have stories.
Yeah.
Institutions have stories. So I'm sure you get the point. I want an education in which we step outside. The book I've, that is with the publisher, but it's probably good. Things tend to take a while.
It's what?
It's called What Does It Mean to Be Human?
Oh, I love it.
You can see how that grew out of this work. I'm afraid we get ourselves within systems of meaning that contain us. All around, even the smaller ones. And when we stay within those for too long and don't recognize their histories and who developed them and how they developed, who was left out, who was defined differently, so forth, it gets into the meaning system. We don't even know it's there. And we can do great harm without meaning to.
The title of the book again, or the thought of the book again, is what?
What does it mean to be human?
So I hope you'll have some suggestions as to how we can go about achieving that, a full humanity, and avoiding some of these the problems we've been talking about.
Yes, I do. I obviously, I believe profoundly in education. I would make sure that as many people as possible have an education, and to have training and be aimed at jobs, professions, and also be liberal arts. It may and may not be directly aimed at a profession. Every single class, every single course ought to be practicing this kind of reflexive thinking, putting things in context, getting us off our one tracks and outside of our fishbowls.
Can that be done in small groups, a self-tutor, self-taught small groups with maybe a guide or agenda? How is it best to go about that, even if you weren't part of that particular university? How can we all go about a little more awareness? Have you thought about that? Is it small groups, large groups? Is it books? What can we do to make ourselves better citizens in this day and age?
Philosopher Kant advised us to go traveling.
Yes.
And I mentioned that earlier. Books help us travel. Movies help us travel. Plays help us travel. Small groups help us travel. Being amongst people we don't know well help us travel. Putting ourselves in situations and paying attention to them help us travel. We have active minds. We're creatures of minds. And the ordinary is so rich in opportunity. We don't need to be huddling inside our little bubbles.
I like it. I like it. Of course. Wow. We've been talking to Elizabeth Minnick, and her book is, where'd it go? The Evil of Banality, on the Life and Death Importance of Thinking. And that's what you're going to help us do with your next book, I hope. And we thank you for that. Any final thoughts? We got about 3 minutes. What do you think?
Well, so as not to lose the possibility, I want to thank you for the work that you do.
It's
very important. You want to talk about what serves this greater aliveness that we're capable of, that makes us less likely to do harm. Conversation, listening to each other. You are doing very important work. And the people who listen to you and then talk to each other, don't forget that. I'm happy to have that be my final word. Thank you for what you're doing.
Wow. Talking to each other. What a good idea. Mm-hmm. I'll try to do more of that. I think we should all do more of that. Not let this thing just gradually roll over us or take us by stealth. Thank you, Elizabeth, for your work and for your ongoing. I hope you'll tell me about your new book and come back on the air and when we can talk about it again. And thanks for your thoughtfulness and for a little teaching me a little bit how to think as I read your book. It took quite a while. I'm not a fast reader, it's small print. But I really, every paragraph just made me think a little bit more. So you've achieved your purpose, at least with at least one reader. And I appreciate it. So keep going. Keep doing what you're doing. We'll all try to do a little bit better. Our next program on the air right now is going to be Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, which she covers the world in all sorts of ways and keeps us aware of what's going on. So thank you again, Elizabeth Minnick. Her latest book is The Evil of Banality, on the life and death importance of thinking. And we got 20 seconds. Any final thoughts?
Well, I'm delighted that Amy Goodman is coming up next. That's